海紧缺人才培训工程教学系列丛书，英语高级口译资格证书考试，高级口译教程第二版，梅德明编著，由上海外语音像出版社录制出版，第四盒。
Unit 9, Cultural Exchange, Text for Interpretation, Passage 1, Chinese English Interpretation, Text Interpreting. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
女士们，先生们，我愿借此机会与大家谈一谈中国人民的一些基本价值观念。不了解这些，就难以把握中国正在和将要发生的事。中华民族历来尊重人的尊严和价值。还在遥远的古代，我们的先人就已提出“民为贵”的思想，认为天生万物，为人为贵。一切社会的发展和进步都取决于人的发展和进步，取决于人的尊严的维护和价值的发挥。今天中国所焕发出来的巨大活力，是中国人民拥有广泛自由民主的生动写照。中国在公元一世纪人口就已达到过6000万左右，众多人口的衣食住行几千年来一直是中国历代政府所要解决的首要人权问题。今天的中国是一个有12多亿人口的发展中大国，必须首先保证最广大人民的生存权和发展权，不然一切其他权利都无从谈起。中国确保12亿多人的生存权和发展权，这是对世界人权进步事业的重大贡献。集体人权与个人人权，经济社会文化权利与公民政治权利紧密结合和协调发展，这是适合中国国情，因而是中国人权事业发展的必然道路。中华民族历来坚持独立自主的民族精神和发展道路。中国人民把独立自主当作立国之本，在5000多年的不懈奋斗中创造了灿烂的中华文明，并在近代反抗外来侵略、实现民族解放的斗争中自立自强，最终掌握了自己的命运。独立自主、自力更生，同学习外国、吸取世界文明的成果，是相互结合、相辅相成的。中华民族的先人们早就懂得这个道理，中国的汉唐时代都曾在这方面留下了宝贵的历史经验。当时既是中国自强不息发展自己的昌盛时期，也是积极开展对外交流、广泛吸收外来进步文化的时期。今天中国人民坚持走自己的路，进行经济政治文化建设，把祖国建设成为一个初步繁荣昌盛的社会主义国家，同时积极吸收和借鉴世界一切先进的文明成果，这些文明成果对于中国的发展也起了重要的促进作用。当然，这种对外国文明的吸收和借鉴绝不能是简单的模仿，中国既不能照抄西方资本主义国家的发展模式，也不能硬搬其他国家建设社会主义的模式，而必须走适合自己国情的发展道路。这就是建设有中国特色社会主义的道路。中国人民将坚定不移地沿着这条强国之路走下去。中华民族历来珍惜各民族大团结和祖国统一。中国的56个民族从古代开始就在华夏大地上劳动和繁衍，经过长期的相互帮助、相互学习，形成了统一的多民族国家。维护中华民族的团结统一，是中华民族伟大复兴的根本基础，是全国各族人民的根本利益所在。新中国成立以后， 中国在少数民族聚集的地方实行区域自治，各民族的权益受到宪法保障，民族地区的社会和经济不断发展，各民族之间的平等、团结、互助关系不断加强。中国民主革命的伟大先行者孙中山先生早就指出，中国是一个统一的国家，这一点已牢牢地印在我国的历史意识之中。正是这种意识，才使我们能作为一个国家而被保存下来。中华文明绵绵几千年，国家统一始终是中国历史的主流，维护国家统一是中国人民世世代代极其珍视的崇高目标。世界上只有一个中国，实现中国的完全统一是全体中国人民的共同愿望。中华民族历来爱好自由和平，中国人民始终希望天下太平，希望同各国人民友好相处。亲仁善邻一直为我们的先人奉为国之宝珍。中国人民在近代饱受战争和被侵略的痛苦，更深感自由与和平的珍贵。任何一个国家的建设和发展都需要一个和平稳定的国际国内环境，任何一个国家和民族的自由都是一切个人自由的前提和基础。我们希望各国人民都生活在没有战争和暴力的世界里，希望各国人民都能享有不被人压迫、歧视和欺凌的自由。中国人民选择和实践的社会主义发展道路和各项基本的内外政策，源于现代中国历史发展的必然，也源于中华民族千百年来形成的优良民族传统，因而具有历史和现实的充分依据和牢固基础。我们的目标是到中华人民共和国成立100周年时基本实行现代化，把中国建成富强、民主、文明的社会主义国家。中国人民有信心克服和战胜前进道路上出现的各种困难和风险，实现我们的伟大目标。
Passage 2 English Chinese Interpretation Text Interpreting. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
As the fifth of the lecture series, The Greatest Arts of the Past Millennium, I'd like to introduce briefly Australia's Sydney Opera House, which is one of the landmark buildings of modern times, and its creator, the reclusive great Danish architect, Jørn Utzon. The Sydney Opera House is the mother and father of all modern landmark buildings, although its architect was forced to resign and it was never properly finished inside. The Opera House has come to define not only a city but also an entire nation and continent. Beyond that, it is a global expression of cultural modernity. Everyone in the world with media access knows what the Sydney Opera House looks like. First designed in 1957 and finally declared complete in 1973, the Opera House was the single best-known modern building in the world until the arrival of Frank Gehry's equally extraordinary Bilbao Guggenheim in 1997. But it will outlive the Guggenheim as an international architectural icon, because it did all the difficult work first. In the pantheon of classic modern buildings, Utzon's creation has the status of myth. The myth states that the unknown architect, then in his early 30s, submitted rough sketches to the competition judges, that he ignored most of the rules, that his design was only selected after being plucked at the last moment from the reject pile by one of the judges, and that the design was unbuildable. But Sydney is remarkable for another reason. It is a complete one-off. It does not fit into any stylistic or chronological category. None of Utzon's other buildings, churches, government departments, houses, look anything like it. And architects today who try to copy his concept always end up looking very second-rate indeed. It is modern, certainly, but it is an expressive modernism that was quite at odds with the rectilinear international style of its time. It has more in common with the work of the American maverick genius Frank Lloyd Wright, for whom Utzon worked briefly. Of course, its unique location is an enormous help, sitting as it does on a promontory with water on three sides and the famous Sydney Harbour Bridge as a picture postcard backdrop. But Utzon masterfully exploited the site as nobody else could. Utzon left Australia in high dudgeon in 1966, never to return, before he could finish designing the interior. As with Sir Christopher Wren at the world-renowned St. Paul's Cathedral, Utzon was humiliated and removed from overseeing the final stages of his masterwork. But for all his manifold difficulties, which other contemporary architect can claim an equivalent achievement? The Sydney Opera House showed us that anything is possible, and it demonstrated that sheer seductive beauty, for its own sake, is nothing to be ashamed of, but everything to be proud of.
Extra text for practice. Passage 1. Chinese English interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
现代化的交通与传播手段使世界变得越来越小，整个国际社会好似一个巨大的地球村。 有着不同文化背景的地球村的村民们在文化交流和文化冲击中和睦相处。当代社会任何一个民族其先进文化不是孤立的现象，而是与其他民族的文化进行广泛交流的产物。当然，任何一个民族的文化其根基与主流必须具有这个民族的鲜明特征。 文化交流不是让外国文化吞没自己的文化，而是为了丰富和充实本民族的文化。通过文化交流，不同的文化可以相互学习、相互影响。在文化领域里，相互影响是一种非常复杂的现象。打个比喻，吸取外国文化是一个入口、咀嚼和消化的过程。 我们应该采取去伪存真、去粗存精、多出幽静、抵御腐蚀的原则。我不认为各种文化的不同特点和风格会因此而消失。相反，不同的文化可以取长补短、互为补充。事实上，随着中国经济的发展和人民生活水平的提高， 中国人民的视野开阔了，艺术鉴赏力也起了变化。他们的兴趣变得广泛了。他们不仅关心中国传统文化艺术和现代文化艺术，而且有了解世界文化发展趋势的愿望，有了解不同艺术风格和流派的愿望。我们在吸取外国文化优秀成果的同时， 不能满足于一味模仿的做法。沉溺于简单的模仿会使自己失去创作力，无法达到新的艺术高度，无法向世界推出自己的优秀作品。简单模仿全然不能与新意划等号。新意是现代风格与传统风格的结合，是外国特色与本民族特色的结合，
是艺术性与教育性的结合。Passage 2. English-Chinese interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Today I'd like to address the topic of the United States as a multicultural society, as much as I understand it. And in that connection, I'd like to say a few words about the implications of multiculturalism for cross-cultural communication. Some people say that the United States is a melting pot, while others say it is a salad platter. In my view, rather than a melting pot, the United States today may be more accurately described as a multicultural society in which acculturation is defined more in terms of integration than assimilation. In other words, people in the United States today can maintain some original cultural identity and values and participate meaningfully in the larger society. The melting pot myth is never true. The United States has always been a heterogeneous society with cohesion based partly on mutual respect and partly on one group's values dominating all others. The salad platter analogy suggests that the elements of the salad maintain their own taste or identity, but exist together to create the whole. Some people argue that multiculturalism has not meant the integration of diverse cultures, but an acceptance by the dominant ethnic category of the exotic foods, dress, and rituals of the cultural minorities. I think that the debate over multiculturalism is essentially the debate over whose values will be imposed. In a true multicultural society, individuals from diverse cultural backgrounds exist without socially enforced power differences. But that is not the case, at least, with the United States. Perhaps there has never been such a thing as monocultural society. Indeed, each person is of many cultures simultaneously. One has a sexual identity, a racial identity, a religious identity, a class identity, a school identity, an identity from the friends one keeps, a family identity, a geographic identity, and so on. We tend to be relatively unconscious of other cultures, and unfortunately, much hostility is created by our ignorance of other cultures and the failure to recognize their existence. In many societies, there is hierarchy of status and power. The power elites need not be the majority. The power elites are the individuals who have influence within the social, political, legal, economic, and religious institutions. In the United States, the power elite controls both the material resources and the goods of the country and the means and manner of production and distribution. In the United States, when you speak of upper, middle, and lower classes, you speak not of national origin or ethnicity, but of power and control over material resources. Economic power in the United States today is largely held by youthful, able-bodied white males. Whites in the United States recognize the existence of a white culture. White culture resulted from a synthesis of ideas, values, and beliefs inherited from European ethnic groups in the United States. As the dominant culture in the United States, white culture is the foundation of social norms and organizations. In terms of cross-cultural communication, the dominant white culture includes communication patterns of standard English, direct eye contact, limited physical contact, and controlled emotions. Non-dominant groups are supposed to follow that pattern in one way or another. A multicultural society, therefore, faces the communication challenges presented by multiple language use, contrasting values, and cultural prejudice.
Unit 10. Science Report. Text for interpretation. Passage 1. Chinese English Interpretation. Text Interpreting. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
女士们，先生们。 我很高兴在这里向各位简单介绍一下我国的传统医学，即中医。中医起源于6000年前的神农氏时代，这位著名的中国古代药王所生活的时代，被认为是中医史上的萌芽阶段。战国时期的中医理论著作《黄帝内经》，标志着 中国医学独特的理论体系的形成，《黄帝内经》至今仍然被视为指导中医的理论基础。中医名著《神农本草经》总结了秦朝前的经验，共载药物365种，按主治、功用和毒性分成三大类， 是中国的一部历史最悠久的要点。中医学在长期的发展过程中，逐渐形成了一整套医学原则和观点。首先，中医认为万物人为贵，中医将救死扶伤视为职业道德规范。第二，中医注重无病防病， 强调以食补保健来延缓衰老，减少疾病。第三，中医理论认为，社会环境与自然环境相互作用、相互依存，人的身心也是一种相互作用、互为依存的关系。人体是由各种器官和不同功能系统组成的有机整体，因此 中医师是通过了解人与自然、人与社会、人体与心理之间的关系，以及人体各部位之间的种种关系，来诊断病人的疾病。第四，中医学认为，阴与阳存在于人体内，相互作用，互为依存。根据中医的哲学观， 阴阳两者对立制约，互根互用，消长平衡，相互转化。阴阳平衡是健康的要素，阴阳失衡会影响健康，导致疾病。因此，中医十分重视调节阴阳，以保平衡。最后，中医认为人体内的系列运动贯穿于人的一生， 这种系列运动在西医叫做新陈代谢。如果这种运动受阻，就会出现异常情况，人就会得病。这是中医关于疾病防治的一个指导思想。在长期的实践和发展中，中医形成了一个以中草药为核心的完整独立的理论体系和疗效独特的临床治疗方法。 除了中草药外，还包括针灸疗法、按摩推拿和气功疗法。今天，中医以其独特的疗效和科学本质，赢得了全世界的广泛赞誉。我国积极发展中医，鼓励中西医结合诊断和治疗。目前，全国各地约有2500家中医医院， 拥有一支50多万人的中医专业队伍。在中国，100万家综合医院中，大部分都设有中医部。此外，全国还有100多家中医机构和研究中心。我相信，我国的中医研究前程似锦。
Passage 2. English-Chinese interpretation. Text interpreting. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am very happy to meet with so many scholars at this annual astrobiology conference in the beautiful city of San Francisco. I am also very happy that we will be discussing some of the big issues, like where we came from and whether we have companions beyond Earth. Here I'd like to share with you some of our recent discoveries. As regards the origin of life on Earth, we used to believe that when life began on Earth, the atmosphere contained nitrogen, hydrogen, and other gases, but no oxygen. Consequently, the sun's rays prevented life from developing on land. That explained why the first living organisms developed only under the sea. Under the influence of photosynthesis, the oxygen in the atmosphere increased and life expanded. Complex living organisms developed. As the oxygen in the atmosphere increased, life, which depends on the equilibrium of the atmosphere, was possible on the surface of the Earth. Recently, we have come up with a very different hypothesis. We believe that hundreds of millions of years ago, a meteor crashed into a then lifeless planet. Embedded in the meteor were carbon compounds that were to become the seeds of all life on Earth. Our current hypothesis is that there was a seedling from elsewhere. Let's say a meteor that had originated in Mars landed in the Antarctic, and it contained evidence of life. We often ask why we are here, how life started, and if we are alone in the universe. These fundamental questions are often addressed by religion and by our sense of aesthetics, by spiritual feelings, feelings of values. But I think science can contribute to the best answers to these questions. In general, scientists are responsible to inform the public, to find out what they want, and to answer the questions that the public wants to know about nature. Last month, we observed the Leonid meteor showers, which occur in every November when Earth passes through the debris shed by the comet Temple-Tuttle. We were aboard two U.S. Air Force craft that flew at night from the United Kingdom to Israel, then back through the Azores to Florida. The path allowed us to observe the meteors, some no bigger than a grain of sand, from an altitude of 11.5 kilometers. Images of the meteors were fed through infrared spectrographic instruments that can detect the unique chemical fingerprints of complex organic molecules of the type that may have seeded life on Earth. Our spectrographic instruments caught a meteor in the act of disseminating organic molecules. We have a list of perhaps 100 carbon-containing compounds that have been identified. These are the building blocks of life. We use the term prebiotic life to describe them. So that is a major interest of astrobiology, to search for the chemicals that exist in the universe outside of Earth that could lead to life, probably in some sort of continuous process. We may ask ourselves if we are ready, psychologically, to accept the possibility of life elsewhere. We must recognize that what we're doing is simply part of the trend that began with Copernicus and Galileo, who first showed us that Earth is not the center of the universe. That, and later discoveries that our galaxy is one of billions, with countless possibilities for life, indicates that we're part of something truly grand in every sense of that word. That's all for my presentation. Thank you for your attention.
Extra text for practice. Passage 1. Chinese English interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
女士们,先生们, 几百年来,中国向全世界传播了其在5000年的历史长河中所积累的医疗保健知识。今日,中国的传统保健方法,如太极拳、气功和按摩等,正日益显示其重要性。中国人认为,太极是天地万物之根源。 太极分为阴阳二气，阴阳二气产生木、火、土、金、水这五行。五行代表或作用于人体器官，即火对心，木对肝，土对脾胃，金对肺，水对肾。阴阳化合而生万物，太极 则代表了阴阳调和。据《易经》记载，保持身心平衡是健康的要素。中医理论著作《黄帝内经》开卷第一章提出了心神怡然以保气防病的理论。这一理论已成为当今气功健身研究的基础理论。太极拳、气功和按摩 这健身三法就是以《易经》和《黄帝内经》提出的理论为基础的。长期以来，世界只知道中国有指南针、火药、造纸和活字印刷四大发明，几乎很少有人知道中国已经发现了经络的存在。经络是指人体内 气血运行通路的主干与分支网络，针刺穴位散布其间。北京经络研究中心通过现代科学方法已经证实了经络的存在。经络的发现无疑是为《易经》和《黄帝内经》的理论提供了强有力的佐证。今天，世界各地学打太极拳、 学做气功以及学习按摩的人越来越多。这些健身之法不仅对人体健康有效，而且对心脑健康、性功能健康以及减肥都有很好的疗效。Passage
2. English-Chinese Interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
My topic today is the car and air pollution. In particular, I want firstly to discuss the ways in which the car causes air pollution, and secondly, how we can control or reduce air pollution from the car. First then, how does the car cause air pollution? What happens is that the car's internal combustion engine is a kind of chemical factory on a small scale. It uses a mixture of petrol and air, and this mixture explodes and burns to produce the energy which propels the car. But while this is happening, many complicated chemical reactions are taking place. In particular, part of the petrol-air mixture is not completely burned up, and so the exhaust gases from the engine contain some very dangerous chemicals, such as carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides, lead, and hydrocarbons. This is the situation, then, and it's going to get much worse unless we do something about it. So, let's focus our attention now on ways of controlling or reducing the amount of air pollution caused by the car. I want to mention 5 possibilities. First, we can discourage the use of cars. For example, we can put higher taxes on petrol and on cars themselves, especially the larger ones that use a lot of petrol. Second, we can encourage alternative methods of transport, both between and within urban areas. For instance, we can make train and bus services cheaper and more convenient. And we can build a mass transit system in large cities, particularly an underground railway system such as those in London, New York, Moscow, and Tokyo. Next, we can use a different and cleaner fuel for the internal combustion engine. Possibilities in this regard include natural gas, fuel cells, i.e. batteries, and liquid hydrogen. Fourth, we can replace the present internal combustion engine with other designs. There are several possibilities being researched at present, such as electric, gas turbine, and steam engines. However, each of these engine designs has its own disadvantages. Last but not least, we are trying to control the emissions from the internal combustion engine much more strictly. This, for example, is a catalytic converter, which converts the most dangerous ingredients of the car exhaust into water and harmless gases. These are 5 possible ways, then, of controlling air pollution caused by cars. As I'm sure you can see, there are problems with each of these ways, but at least they're a step in the right direction. Probably the best answer is a synthesis of all 5.
Passage 3. Chinese English interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
野生大熊猫的数目已不足1000只。 大熊猫濒临绝迹，拯救国宝大熊猫已成为中国人民的共同心愿。最近，我们将大熊猫体细胞的一个细胞核植入一个兔子的去核卵子里，培育出一个大熊猫胚胎。现在，我们将精力集中在克隆大熊猫的第2步上，即。 把胚胎植入另一只动物的子宫里生长。自20世纪90年代初以来，我们用人工受精的方法增加大熊猫数量，也就是说，我们通过注入性激素，控制母本的体温和排卵期，以得到卵子，然后让父本的精子与母本的卵子结合，培植新的生命。 在过去的6年中，我们用这种方法已繁殖出6对双胞胎和7个单胞胎。但是，就整个大熊猫家族的命运来说，人工受精的方法远未令人满意。此外，通常大熊猫产生的卵子和精子数量很少，所以当雌性大熊猫无法交配时，这种方法。 也就起不了作用。1997年，开始实施一个更为雄心勃勃的计划——克隆大熊猫。1998年，中国科学院在这个项目上投入了专款，并在1999年得到了科学技术部的资助。这项实验旨在将大熊猫体细胞的细胞核植入去核卵子。 以造就一个全新的生命。我们注意到，畸形、死胚和夭折现象经常发生在克隆动物身上。统计数字显示，在自然分娩中，畸形胚胎基因不到1%，试管婴儿的畸形胚胎基因为15%， 而克隆动物的畸形胚胎基因为 50%。 真正的问题是克隆大熊猫的第二步，即在另一种动物的子宫里培育新的大熊猫。目前我们还无法肯定哪一种动物是理想的代母体。也许你会问，胚胎既然是在兔子的卵子里培养的，那么兔子应该是母体。然而问题是，兔子的子宫对于大熊猫幼体来说实在太小了。此外，大熊猫的妊娠期为87天至170天，而兔子的妊娠期却不到30天，兔子怎能怀上大熊猫？另一个问题是，即使大熊猫克隆出来，它只有亲本的 DNA， 因此在某种程度上，克隆方法是无法保护大熊猫的。如果幼体大熊猫与代母亲一起生活，比如说与狗母亲或熊母亲一起生活，学习母亲的行为和习性，那么它只能成为一只有着大熊猫身体的狗或熊。如果是这样的话，克隆大熊猫还有什么意义呢？不管怎样，克隆大熊猫还是引起了人们的极大兴趣。无情的事实是，大熊猫的繁殖能力太弱，大熊猫已濒临灭绝。当然，克隆大熊猫并不意味着取代大熊猫的自然繁殖，恰恰相反，克隆只是对自然繁殖和人工繁殖的一种补充。我们认为，只要克隆方法有利于保护大熊猫，我们就要尝试。即使我们获得一个克隆的大熊猫，我们仍然需要做更多的实验来完善克隆技术。克隆技术目前仍处于研究阶段，而不是生产阶段。我们科学家所要做的是在实验中学习，通过学习改进我们的研究。克隆大熊猫是发展和改进克隆技术的一种方法，这种方法一旦成功，可以用来拯救其他一些濒临灭绝的动物。当然，我们还应该充分意识到，大熊猫生存的主要威胁不是来自于大熊猫的繁殖能力，而是来自于人类对大熊猫自然生态环境的破坏，这是任何一种克隆技术都无法弥补的。我国政府早已明令禁止在长江中上游砍伐树木，这对保护大熊猫及其生态环境无疑是一个良好的开端。随着大熊猫的自然生态环境的不断改善，随着克隆技术的不断完善，大熊猫一定会生存下去。我们对大熊猫的未来充满信心。
Passage 4. English-Chinese interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese. Traditional Chinese medicine says that good health is associated with the balance of qi, an energy force that flows through the body. Qi can be hindered or helped by yin and yang, opposing forces that, when balanced, work harmoniously together. According to traditional theory, the goal of acupuncture is to promote the flow of qi by keeping yin and yang in balance. And this is done by inserting needles at various points along primary channels and meridians that crisscross the body. In China, acupuncture is used to alleviate post-operative pain. Medical experts believe that inserting needles into the body at precise points can stimulate nerves that cause the brain to release its natural pain-killing chemicals. There is sufficient evidence in the literature that shows a positive effect between the technique of acupuncture itself, stimulating these acupuncture points in the skin, and the release of substances in the brain which we know to be associated with the relief of pain. The U.S. National Institute of Health has endorsed acupuncture for treating certain types of nausea, vomiting, and pain, such as the nausea sort of sickness that a patient suffers when given an anesthetic for surgery, or treated with chemotherapy, or the vomiting or nausea that accompanies pregnancy or post-operative dental pain. We have come to the very clear-cut sort of decision that treatment under these circumstances really works. Our principal concern in evaluating acupuncture's effectiveness has been the so-called placebo effect, the possibility that beneficial outcomes derive not from the treatment itself, but from the patient's belief that it works. We got around the problem by measuring brain chemistry during acupuncture. Drugs were administered to block the brain's natural opiates while the patient was undergoing needle stimulation. As a result of the opiate blockage, the acupuncture had no effect in stopping pain, proving that there is a physiological mechanism to acupuncture that goes beyond mere belief. Acupuncture is widely employed in easing cravings and withdrawal pains of heroin addicts. 40% of the drug courts in the United States use acupuncture as part of their therapy. In the Miami system alone, there are close to 400 treatments per day. In some countries, such as Sweden, the doctors have had success with acupuncture in treating the effects of stroke. Those stroke patients getting acupuncture along with physical therapy did a lot better than those getting physical therapy alone. Studies show that one of the key benefits of acupuncture that seems to be emerging from various studies is that it has few, if any, side effects, and that when used with standard drug treatment, in anesthesia, for example, it allows physicians to cut back on medication, delivering the same level of benefit with fewer negative effects.
Unit 11. Catering Culture. Text for Interpretation. Passage 1. Chinese English Interpretation. Text Interpreting. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from Chinese into English.
我国悠久的历史、广袤的国土，与世界各国和海外文化的广泛接触，孕育了中餐烹饪的独特艺术。几千年的推陈出新和不断累积，使中餐受到越来越多的海外人士的青睐。 成了我国对外文化交流的友好使者。现代中国已享有烹饪王国之美誉，精致的烹调艺术盛行全球，中餐烹饪已名列世界顶尖菜系之林。中餐烹调所用的天然配料品种繁多，几无穷尽，烹调方法亦层出不穷，不可悉数。 这些无以伦比的中餐烹饪特点，足以说明了中餐馆以及中餐烹调之所以名扬海外的缘由。评判中餐烹调的优劣，可根据中餐的三大要素，即色、香、味。色作为色香味三要素当中的首要标准，充分体现在宴会菜肴的 装盘、摆放和图案上，最能显示色彩的是首先上桌的那道煞费苦心而精心制作的冷盘。香， 不仅是指鼻子对食物的直接感受，它还包括所选原料的新鲜程度以及佐料的合理调配。味则体现了恰到好处的调味艺术，当然它也包括食物的质地以及切菜的刀工。色、香、味这三大要素的高品质，只有通过选料、调料、适时烹调、把握火候、装盘上桌这些微妙步骤的细心协调才能取得。八人一桌的标准晚餐含四道冷盘、四道热炒，外加汤和米饭。外国宾客见之，常常惊叹不已，将其视为一次丰盛的晚宴。但在中国人眼里，以这种规格的晚餐招待宾客，只是一种起码的标准。准备十道分量适中的菜肴并不为过，即使献上十六道菜已不足为奇。在中国，一桌标准宴席包括四至八个事先制好的冷盘，八道现做的热炒，两道观赏性的大菜，如全鱼、乳猪、全鸡等。此外还有汤、米饭和点心，晚宴结束前还有一道水果。来华访问的海外宾客应记住，赴宴不可贪吃，每道菜浅尝辄止。从这个角度上来讲，中国宴席犹如西方国家的冷餐招待会。中国宴席桌上的酒通常为啤酒、黄酒和烈性白酒三种，人们往往以干杯的方式互相敬酒。干杯的意思是一口喝干杯中的酒，干了杯中的酒可以表示心诚和欢乐。当然，外国宾客与中国东道主敬酒时，小嘬一口也未尝不可。但是，中国的普通家餐却完全不同于宴席。一个成年人平时在家就餐时，通常只吃两小碗米饭，或一大碗面条，或几只馒头，外加几个荤素炒菜，而非以菜为主，以米饭或面食为辅。对大多数中国人来说，从一餐饭中所摄取的热量有65%来自谷粮。作为一种世代相袭的传统，中国人就餐时围桌而坐，人人手里都有一碗主食，炒菜放在桌子中央，大家一起食用。这一古老的风俗习惯反映了食物在中华文明史上的重要地位。占据餐桌中心位置的是炒菜而不是鲜花，晚餐的主要话题常常是食物。菜肴的各种色彩和材料搭配给人以美的享受。共食一碗菜的习俗有助于家庭成员之间的团结和友谊。当然，在一些卫生意识比较强的地方，人们在共食放在餐桌中央的菜肴时，必须使用公筷或公用汤勺，以防疾病传染。以上所介绍的情况，对外国客人来说，虽不应是一种离奇的天方夜谭，却也说明中国人在饮食方面所持的价值观与西方人有很大的不同。不过，中国人民与世界各民族人民都有一个相同的基本观念，即亲朋好友相聚，美酒佳肴相尽，实属人生之最大快乐也。
未来，伴随你走向。